Today, my guest is the executive director of the MIT Leadership Center. With 10 books translated into 15 languages under his name, he is the founder of the 424 Project, an initiative dedicated to rethinking the provocative power of asking the right questions. In this episode, we discuss how to cultivate innovative and disruptive ideas. Ladies and gentlemen, my guest, Hal Gregersen. Hal, how are you?
I'm doing fantastic, Yuri. Thank you. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you for taking the time. I know you're a very busy man these days.
We're all busy at the end of the day.
Do you ever have a quiet time, or is it just all year long? You just go, go, go?
Quiet times each day. My best moments are early in the morning.
Okay.
We live near the Atlantic Ocean, and I generally, but not religiously, get up, look at the seagulls, and step back and do some meditation.
That's a beautiful way to start the day.
It is. It's a really grounded way to start the day, actually. You're right.
Is that something that you always practice, meditation, or is something that you kind of develop over the years?
A combination of both. When I was in college, I actually took a yoga meditation class and found it incredibly helpful and focusing. I did not know then that I had adult ADHD, but I learned that later in life. But the meditation process was then super helpful in terms of enabling me to stay more focused. And then a number of years ago, I had the chance to meet Ed Catmull, one of the co-founders of Pixar, and for the last number of years, president of Disney Animation and Pixar Animation. And Ed is an ardent meditator, deeply committed to it, and far more consistent and regular than I am. And that interaction and conversation with Ed caused me to reflect back on my younger days, and I decided to reboot, restart, and come back into that space.
Meditation is a topic that you keep hearing more and more these days. A lot of high-level professionals and creative people are using to tune in their skills or even with themselves. But still, do you think we walk away a little bit with the stigma with meditation to a religious practice?
Well, I used religiously, not intending to mean religious in that classic use of the word. So for me, the part of the reason I care deeply about it, perhaps now more than ever before, is in this research work I've been engaged with the past 4 to 5 years around what causes creative leaders in any space to ask the better question, or ideally ones that would disrupt and change the world for the better. One of those conditions was they were reflectively quiet. They created the space with intentionality to step back, reflect, and try to make sense of what's going on. And meditation is one of many ways in which we can do that. And so I've found it helpful not only on a settling dimension and an anchoring dimension, but also on a way by which I could also ask a better question as I go throughout the day.
And that's also one aspect of the work that I think is fascinating, because we live in an environment that everybody's looking for the right answers. You are pretty much arguing that it's not about that. It's about finding the proper and the better questions. Is that something that you always struggle? At what point did you come up with the conclusion? It's not so much about the answer, but it's about what are you asking?
Well, there are two answers to that question. For me, one is when I was a young boy, I grew up in a family where, for better or worse, my father, I think, grew up in a far worse situation. But my father was the center of our house. He was, in our terms today, emotionally abusive and sometimes physically. And I learned quite young that asking questions could be a way of positively deflecting those negative influences to myself or other people in the family. I could not have explained it or said what I just said 60 years ago, but 50 years ago, whatever it would have been. But I now understand now in retrospect, early on, I learned that questions were a great way to protect yourself when you're under threat. And so that was the early on sort of surprise about it. But then, you know, I've always been deeply inquisitive. And 25 years ago, I had the chance to become a researcher. My first big project was about global leaders moving from one country to the other, dropping in a new environment, not knowing the language, not knowing the culture, not knowing the business, but being responsible for succeeding in the business. And this would have been A.G. Laffley, who was one of the leaders I interviewed was A.G. And this was 25 years ago when I interviewed him, long before he became the CEO of Procter & Gamble. But A.G. was one of those incredible global leaders who could drop in a new environment and succeed. And I swear, Yuri, I got asked more questions by A.G. than the number of questions I asked him. And what I learned then is the same thing I learned in learning how leaders lead innovation and change. And it's the same thing I learned in this last 5 years of research about creative leaders, which is when we're operating on the edge of uncertainty, we're in that world of unknown, questions really are the answer because the answers aren't there. They're to be discovered. And the only path to get there in that super unknown, uncertain space is to ask the questions we've never asked before. It's the only path.
So for somebody who's interested to start applying that mindset, do you have a 1, 2, 3 steps?
I'm going to be super practical and focused, which is everybody has some opportunity or challenge sitting in front of them right now today where they want to do something about it, but they actually are stuck. And I think you know the feeling, Yuri, which is I really want to solve this, but I don't know what to do next. If you and I are in that moment, the first simple suggestion I've got is either do it yourself or invite a couple of other people. If you've got two people with you, in 2 minutes or less, quickly explain to them what your challenge or opportunity is. And then tell them, we're going to now spend 4 minutes asking nothing but questions about that issue. No explanations about why we're asking the questions, no answers to any of the questions. We're going to hold ourselves to 4 minutes of questions only. If we follow those two rules, we'll ask 15 to 20 questions. And in that 4 fast minutes, we will 80% of the time be in a better positive emotional mood. 80% of the time, we will have reframed our challenge. And 85% of the time, we have at least one new idea to move it forward. All of that came from just devoting some focused energy and time to asking nothing but questions. So it may sound simplistic. It may sound like some consulting gimmick. All I know is I've done this with literally tens of thousands of leaders over the last 20 years. I've collected systematic research data. Those numbers of 80 and 85% weren't randomly pulled out of the hat. They were actually from research around the impact of that relatively simple process. That is a perfect starting point that could be in your own world, in your own space, with something you deeply care about today.
Now, because you have worked and observed thousands of CEOs and leaders on the subject, one thing that comes to me, and I'm curious to know, is that not so much the idea of asking the right questions, but the ability to ask a question at all. I feel a lot of people might struggle with just the idea of raising their hands and asking questions to their boss or a family member, really engage in some more difficult conversation. How much of that is insecurity or just a fear of making mistakes? Or perhaps this is just a personality trait. Some people are more outgoing and outspoken than others.
I think there's a great quote from over a century ago from Lord Acton, who in the 1800s studied governments and organizations, and he concluded that power tends to corrupt and absolute power corrupts absolutely, which you may have heard that quote before. And this for me in response to inquiry and questioning is power tends to corrupt the questioning process and absolute power corrupts it absolutely, which is so related to what you just asked, Yuri. It's how do we ask someone in authority or power around us a tough question? And a lot of the responsibility for that rests on the leader that we're going to be talking to. Do they go out of their way? I mean, literally, do they as leaders go out of their way to create a safe enough environment with the fewest possible barriers for other people to enter their world, enter their space, and ask them the tough questions, the ones that make the leader uncomfortable and help the leader realize they're wrong. I think the starting point is that we as leaders, whether we're at the top or bottom of an organization, we have to have that assumption that how do I create this environment, this space, a moment, a meeting, a process that would invite other people to ask the questions they otherwise wouldn't ask? And so, again, I mentioned earlier Ed Catmull, I believe, that Ed Catmull, who's the co-founder of Pixar, they learned early on there that directors, the initial director for Toy Story, those directors needed guidance. They needed feedback. They needed help. They needed somebody to give them a question about their work in progress that might be uncomfortable, that might be awkward. And they literally created what they called a brain trust, which was a meeting that the director knew they're walking into, that other directors are going to be there. And my job as the Toy Story director is just to sit and listen to all of their questions, all of their feedback, good and bad. And at the end of that 3-hour meeting, I might be devastated intellectually and emotionally, but I'll walk away with it with ideas to make the movie better. And so even for the people at the top of the system, the directors at a place like Pixar and Disney Animation, they've created this intentional space where people know walking into that room, they're obligated to ask the tough questions in order to make a movie better, to make it excellent. And that's how they have these 20 blockbuster movies.
Is there such a thing as too much feedback? Because we do live in a very fast-paced environment. Decision-making needs to be happening all the time, 24/7. And there's a lot of pressure and responsibilities with some of the decisions. You know, at the end of the day, you can ask 1,000 people and you're going to get 1,000 different questions and answers. At what point do you realize you have all the feedback that you need?
I am not. Even though the book that I just wrote, the title was Questions Are the Answer, I am not advocating just asking questions for questioning's sake. Because we know from the data that if all we do is ask questions, we're annoying. And in fact, when I ask leaders around the world or people working in organizations, if people are, you know, somebody who asks 1,000 questions and their response almost always is, yeah, they're annoying. And frankly, Yuri, I would agree. If all I do is ask questions, I may likely create more problems than I solve. And the way to get beyond that problematic approach to inquiry is to be responsible and to take responsibility to actively problem solve the question that we're asking. And so if you're, Yuri, working furious and hard to get something solved, to make things go forward in your part of the organization, and if I start asking you questions, if my intent is to look clever, that's a waste of your time. But if my questions are honest with the intent to help you solve whatever problem or issue it is you are now wrestling with, you know, those are powerful and productive. And if I'm willing to ask the question and get up and out of my chair and out of my office and into your world and get out and try to do something to find an answer to the question I'm asking with you, that's not annoying. That's usually quite helpful. And so for me, it's not that we stop asking questions. It's that we start asking questions responsibly, which means I'm not doing it to look smart. I'm doing it to do whatever we're doing better.
Browsing through your website, a few things that I noticed that I was very interested in. One, you mentioned about innovators' DNA. That's a topic that you have wrote quite a bit before. Now, on that aspect, I usually ask about creativity, but I guess the innovation is a big part of it. Do you subscribe to the idea that this is something that can be developed? There's way that people right now that can become better at it.
It's a really important question because I generally, when I'm giving speeches or doing workshops, I around the innovator's DNA and the skills related to getting disruptive new ideas, I'll ask the people in the room, how many of you see yourself as innovators? And relatively few hands go up. And then I'll ask, well, how many of you solve problems? And everybody's hand goes up. And then I have them caught in the corner, which is, well, if you're trying to solve a problem and you don't have a solution, what do you have to do? Well, you have to create a new solution. Well, that's a synonym for innovation. And the point is, all of us are problem solvers. And to really create something new and different, we have to innovate. And so part of this whole game, Yuri, is getting beyond the semantics, the words of innovation, and getting to the reality of how do we creatively problem solve. And that's where, with this initial book 10 years ago with the Innovator's DNA, we interviewed 100 of the most disruptive leaders in the world at the most innovative companies in the world. We asked them, what do you do in order to get disruptive new ideas? And we pretended, in one sense, through these interviews, as if we were shadowing their behavioral actions. And what we discovered was that they think differently. They connect the unconnected. We call it thinking associationally, because they act differently. They are regularly asking questions that challenge the status quo. They are regularly observing the world actively, like anthropologists, and getting surprised. They are regularly talking to people and networking with people who are different from them to get new ideas they otherwise wouldn't get. And they are regularly willing to take the risk to experiment and try small, fast, cheap things to move things forward. It's those behaviors that help them get ideas that other people don't get. And so your question initially was, well, are you born that way? Is it genetics? And 5 studies of genetically identical twins, plus our own everyday experience, would say that, yes, part of that, about a third, is genetic, but 2/3 of it is, in fact, skill building. It's the families we grow up in, the schools we go to school in, and the places we work. They either foster this kind of active problem solving, by getting up, getting out, getting into the world, using these discovery skills of questioning and observing and networking and experimenting and associational thinking to solve problems in ways that other people don't. That's how Mark Benioff 20 years ago founded Salesforce, which was based upon a question: what if we sold enterprise level software like Amazon sells books? And that was a question that he did not get by reading some management or creative leadership book. Mark Benioff got that with 15 years of sales at Oracle, on the edge, out in the world, confronting constantly the salespeople, the organizations he was trying to sell to. Mark was regularly wrong. He was uncomfortable. He was quiet. He was actively engaging with the customers. And he realized this is not working. Large enterprise software does not work for small enterprises. And so he talks to hundreds of people in all sorts of contexts, and he finally, with all of this passive data he's collecting in a very active way, he ends up getting a question that creates the cloud and large enterprise software sitting on it. That did not happen by Mark Benioff sitting in his office thinking quietly to himself. So the point for me on this is, Yuri, these are learned skills. You know, we're a merger and acquisition family. So I had 3, she had 4. We have 7 children, 9 grandchildren. And you watch those grandchildren, you watch any 3 or 4-year-old, and what do? Most 3 or 4-year-olds, unless they've grown up in extremely difficult circumstances, most 3 or 4-year-olds around the world, they do exactly what we just said. They ask tons of questions. They watch the world carefully. They talk to anybody. They're willing to try anything, and they connect the unconnected all the time. We all have this at one point. And if we want to get those skills back, we simply have to use them in solving the problems we're facing today.
So you think all those natural skills that we were born with, like a 3 or 4-year-old have, those has been suppressed because, I don't know, perhaps the education system that we have, the parenting style, or even the way we live our lives in general?
Every step of what you just said. So you've got, at the educational level, I don't have data on outside of the U.S., but if I'm 6 years old or 18 years old, if I'm in first grade or 12th grade, here's the data. A teacher in that class asks 50 to 100 questions per hour. And so pretend you're the student, I'm the teacher, I ask you a question, I'll give you 1 second on average to answer that question. If you don't get it, I'll follow up with a different kind of question, give you a half of a second after that And if you don't get it, I'll turn to the next student and ask her. And she has 1 second to answer and a half second on the follow-up question. So basically, teachers are machine guns with inquiry, asking questions in order to get the right answers, in order for students to pass the exams to go to the next grade. That's a simplification, but that's what happens. Students stop asking questions because answers become more important, literally. So on a typical month, I'm sitting in 7 hours of class maybe every day. I'll ask 7 questions total during the entire month about the content of the course. It's no wonder, you know, we lose this questioning capacity as we go out into the world of work. And then it just compounds because a lot of organizations, especially at the lower levels, when these entry-level people come into their organization, it's routinized work. It's sometimes pretty routine. It's people just like do your job. And the way to get promoted is simply to have all the right answers to get moving to the next level. And that continues in a lot of organizations all the way to the top. You get promoted for having the right answers, not asking the right questions. Well, contrast that completely with a place like Bridgewater. You know, Ray Dalio wrote the book, you know, is his recent book about principles. And basically you've got him saying great questions are a much better indicator of future success than great answers. They're looking there at this financial services institution that's been incredibly successful. They want people coming into the system who are deeply inquisitive in order to make it better.
Let's go back a little bit and talk about the education system, because it seems it's pretty clear these days that everybody understands that it is failing our kids. And also there's a lot of discussion about there's so many successful people who have to either drop out or college is so expensive these days. But at the end of the day, it is fundamental that, you know, the kids have a place to learn, a safe place to learn, to make mistakes and improve themselves. Give an example, even a country or a system that you think is close to what we're looking for to be an ideal education system for kids.
Well, my answer would be twofold. There's sort of several layers to it. One is, over the last 10 years, I've interviewed 300 of the world's most innovative leaders, people like Jeff Bezos at Amazon, Elon Musk at Tesla and SpaceX, and so on. At least half of those leaders had what I would call non-traditional educational growing up. And it was either Montessori, maybe international baccalaureate programs, or they were simply in project-oriented environments where you go to school and you're there to figure something out and to make a project work. You're not there just to learn math. In Finland, I lived in Finland 3 times for 3 years, and the Finnish system has a very similar logic to it. You're taking advantage of all of these different learning areas of math, science, English, and so on. You're learning them in order to solve something, not learning them just for the sake of learning them. And so, you know, I had the chance to interview Jeff Bezos a number of years ago, and he's sharing about how he grew up on a farm and in the summers he would go to his grandparents' farm. His grandfather would buy broken down tractors to basically teach Jeff that you might be smart, but the tractor's smarter, and you're going to have to try 20 different solutions in order to fix that tractor. It was project-based learning. And Jeff learned really young to become a relentless problem solver at work and to try to just go at it and go at it and go at it. And ultimately, you'll figure it out. And that's what these other educational systems are doing. That's what's going on in a Montessori school. That's what's happening in many national baccalaureate programs. You know, it's basically creating a project, either formally in school. My brother-in-law had a father who bought him an old broken-down airplane engine when he was growing up in order for him to learn how engines work, and he did that after school. It's creating those sorts of projects that engage young girls, young boys, that end up building these questioning skills and problem-solving skills and innovation skills that will serve them well throughout the rest of their lives.
Sounds like a lot of the examples you gave was parents really taking active input in their kids' life as well.
Absolutely. So Bea Perez, who has worked at Coca-Cola for many years, she's the chief communications, public affairs, and sustainability officer at Coca-Cola. she's got a family and small family, and they come home every day at the end of the day, and she's sitting at the family, and at any point in time, any family member can raise their hand and say, oh, family time, family problem. And they might have some issue going on at school, and they just raise it. Here's the issue. And then they start at the youngest member of the family, who asks questions of that other family member about what's going on with the issue or challenge. And then they talk about it. The next family member asks, the older family member asks questions, does the same sort of thing. Michael Sippy, who is the vice president of product at Medium, he and his wife intentionally selected multi-volume sagas like The Little House on the Prairie in the United States, where you're following this family over the course of several books, their life, their story, the reality, their successes, their anguish, their failures. And they did that intentionally so their kids would ask them questions. It was purposeful around fostering and building that sort of capacity. And so, you know, it could be as simple as instead of asking your kids when they come home at the end of the day, what did you learn? It's like, what questions did you ask at school today? What questions did you not have the chance to ask that we can still talk about? And then those young girls, young boys can grow up like Orit Gadish did in Israel, and in her family, and in questions were valued. And at school, Orit would always, when the teachers had any questions, Orit would raise her hand and have two or three questions. And by the time she graduated from junior high school, the teachers were saying, Orit always asked those two or three questions. So yes, Yuri, it makes a huge difference, whether at home or at school, for us to value the questions that these young people have and nurture them.
Well, I'm loving all of this. I'm a parent of two little girls, so all those great examples, I'm like, okay, I think I can do that as well.
Can I share an example from Debbie Sterling, who created a company called Goldilocks for little girls?
Please do.
So she's an engineer. She goes to engineering school. Then she goes to graduate engineering school. She's got guys all around her. She's one of the few women. She gets her first job, is still one of the few women in the many, 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 many man sort of profession. And she's got a group of women in her neighborhood who have a brunch every once in a while to talk about ideas for entrepreneurial ventures. And another engineering neighbor, she said, you know, when we were little girls, we played with all of the boys' toys, building logs, the Tinker Toys, the sets that, you know, our brothers had. Why did we not have girls' toys for that? And Debbie was like, this is my calling in life to figure this out now. And she ended up getting up, getting out, getting into the world, watching girls play, watching boys play, talking to child psychologists, creating demos of prototypes, and she builds these toys called Goldilocks, where basically girls love to build just as much as boys, but they just have to have a good reason to build. So boys will build for building's sake, but girls will build if there's a reason. What's the point? What's the story? And these science and math and building toys sets that she sells basically accomplishes that for girls and pulls them into that math science world in ways that otherwise wouldn't happen. And so instead of just slapping a pink label on a box of Tinker Toys, she's purposely built this toy with a Goldilocks label that invites the girls, these young girls, into acquiring skills that could help them become the next generation computer scientists or artificial intelligence specialists.
I love that. It's a great story. Earlier, you talked about skill building, and I kind of want to find out more on a personal level for you. In the last 10 years, you've been very involved on the subject. What have you found out about yourself, and what are the skills that you have to develop in the last 10 years to be the professional, the person that you are today?
I think there's a way of approaching the world that Tiffany Schlein, who founded the Webby Awards and does some amazing work now online with videos and character development of kids. Her father told her growing up, Tiffany, if you're not living on the edge, you're taking up too much space. And, you know, that's the invitation to asking better questions. And if you're not living on the edge, you're taking too much space. And so it's putting ourselves in situations over and over where we have the chance to uncover things we didn't know. And when that happens, they're crucible moments. And they are usually causing us to feel wrong and uncomfortable and reflective, and we end up seeing and acting differently in the world. So 4 years ago this spring in 2015, one of those operating on the edge moments for me happened when a friend and colleague, David Brashears, invited me onto a research project to understand the whole ecosystem that supports leadership to get someone to the top of Mount Everest. So I, for a decade, have taught a Harvard Business School case study about the 1996 Everest disaster, where a storm in a very surprising way caught several teams on the top of Everest and many people tragically died. And it's the kind of case study that we use in the business schools all over the world to help leaders make better decisions about leading teams. I had actually had David Brashears, who was one of those team leaders who helped rescue and save other teams that had been caught in this storm, that in that 1996 timeframe. I had asked David to teach with me that case in many classes, and I even would do things like go and get coffee straws that are super small and have the students in the room, the leaders, suck through the straws to simulate what it would like to gasp for breath as you're climbing Everest. In retrospect, it's hilarious. But that's what I did. And when we started thinking about doing this project, David said, Hal, you've got to go to Everest. You've got to go to base camp at least. So I said, you're right, David, even though I knew it was a bit fearful for me. I'm not a mountaineer. I'm not a climber. But I ended up at the last minute, literally with only a few weeks preparation, going on that journey, going on the trek from Kathmandu to Lukla, 10,000 feet, and from Lukla trekking up several days, 12 days or so, up to Everest Base Camp. And all I can tell you is the following. About 5 days into it, I started getting very sick. And there were many days when I got closer and closer to the Everest base camp when I honestly wondered, waking up in the morning, if I keep going, am I going to die or not today? Breathing was arduous. I was coughing horrendously. I finally arrived up at base camp. Doctors checked me. I did have some deep infections in my lungs and in my head, and probably some level of altitude sickness. Rested for a day or so, ended up having enough strength to get up with David one morning, get up into the Khumbu Icefall above Everest Base Camp. And by the end of that morning, I was utterly, completely, fully spent. And I looked at David and said, I've got to get off this mountain. And fortunately, it was a clear day. A helicopter flew up, took me down, ended up flying right home to Boston where I live, went to the hospital, got all the medications I needed to start recovering. And the next day I was woken up by my daughter and wife saying there had been a massive earthquake in Nepal, and there'd been a massive avalanche at Everest Base Camp. Our camp was one of three camps that got smashed, completely destroyed with that avalanche. If I had not been sick and not left, I may well have been there and have no idea what would have happened. It was harrowing retrospect. And I learned what Morpheus in the movie The Matrix said at the end of that whole experience, which was, there's a difference between knowing the path and walking the path. There's a difference between talking and teaching about being at Mount Everest Base Camp and above and being there. And to this day, I am still asking different questions, gaining insights from that harrowing crucible moment at Everest Base Camp and above that would not have happened if I had not made the choice to put myself in conditions that would cause me to see the world differently. So that's a big one, but it literally has changed the way in which I operate in the world.
Wow.
You know, I actually went into that with a very professor kind of researcher mindset in search of the answers. And to be truthful, Yuri, that intention to an obligation I felt to get insights and answers as I walked up the trail to Everest actually blocked me from seeing things and blocked me from insight that would have otherwise come. And very truthfully, I can feel it now 4 years later. There are some questions surfacing from that harrowing experience that will still come, and they will be life-changing, and I will value them incredibly, because some questions just take time in order to surface and change the way we live and work.
It's almost like some questions are worthwhile holding on.
No, exactly. You know, we, as the great poet Rainer said, we have to live into some of these questions. Yeah.
I want to thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it. One thing I do ask for everybody who comes to the podcast is to recommend a book or two.
Oh, my. At 10:15 a.m. this morning, I finished an advanced copy of Melinda Gates' new book, The Moment of Lift, How Empowering Women Changes the World. And I'll be honest with you, it radically revised the way in which I want to act and behave in relationship to my own wife, my own daughters, my own granddaughters, and the women and young girls I operate with and work with and live with and around in the world. It's a powerful treatise for men and women about how we might be equal in a very good, productive, engaging, empowering way. So comes out later this month. I would absolutely pick it up and explore it.
Again, thank you so much for taking the time. I truly, truly appreciate it. Now do me a big favor, tell everybody who's listening how they can find out more about your work and even get a hold of you.
HalGregersen.com explains a lot of my world. HalGregersen at Twitter, all one word, a great way to engage. And I'm always curious about other people's experience that helps them ask better questions that help us build a better world.
Ladies and gentlemen, Hal Gregersen. Hal, thank you very much.
Thank you, Yuri.
Hey everyone, make sure to like, comment, and let us know what you think. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook.